The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
Well, this week on The Cyber Show, Pete talks about scalable cybersecurity education and grows the scales. It surfs before the internet or the ARPANET or much of any net. CogDef at it again. Another pitcher winds up another pitch. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
On April 16th at 9 a.m., Angel to Exit will have an in-person pitch event at the AMA Executive Conference Center at 780 Mission Street in San Francisco. This will include featured investors, startup and emerging tech companies, sponsors and service providers, and a $25,000 investment in one of the presenting companies from that day. Don't miss this opportunity to go into the Shark Tank and see what floats with the investors. For details, go to thecybershow.co and click on the Go to Angel listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. A deep fake emulating a shallow fake was apparently used to fake folks into thinking on the faker's faker, while the deep faker freed from fake responsibility walked away free. Fortunately, a free thinker faked a shallow fake of the deep faker faking the deep fake of the shallow fake, and the deep faker was arrested for fake forgery. And that's breaking news on The Cyber Show. How do we know we're being successful at The Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. 1. We know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. 2. We know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. 3. We know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. 4. We know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And 5. We know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Cognitive Defense is an emerging company helping other companies defend against malicious influence operations. They do this by helping people better defend themselves against exploitation. You can get in touch with Cognitive Defense by going to cogdef.com, that's cogdef.com, or find them through their link at thecybershow.co.
Cognitive Defense will be holding a webinar on countering influence operations and social engineering Tuesday, March 26th at 9 a.m. Pacific. Sign up by contacting them at cogdef.com.
Frauds, Spies, and Lies and How to Defeat Them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. Here's an email I got from Medicare, which of course is the healthcare system for the elderly, which I guess I'm part of in the United States, as well as people that have various disabilities and are otherwise covered for one reason or another.
Here are three tips to protect yourself from Medicare fraud and scams. If you get a call, text, or email asking for your Medicare number, don't respond. Don't give your Medicare card or Medicare number to anyone except your doctor or people you know should have it. Check your Medicare summary notices, MSNs, or claims statements carefully. If you see a charge for a service you didn't get or a product you didn't order, it may be fraud. If you suspect fraud, report it at 1-800-MEDICARE, 1-800-633-4227. Guard your Medicare card like it's a credit card.
As usual, the places like Medicare really only want to tell you things that happen that have to do with you, what you shouldn't do, what they will do, and so forth. They really don't tell you about what the bad guys will do. So I thought I would help interpret what they say by telling you what the bad guys will do based on what they say you should not do. So here we go.
Medical identity theft is a serious crime that happens when someone uses your personal information without your consent to commit Medicare fraud or other crimes.
So here we start to see the first thing to understand is they're trying to protect themselves from fraud. And, well, protecting you from other crimes, that's a secondary consideration, apparently.
Use the following tips to protect yourself from becoming a victim. Remember that Medicare will never call you to sell you anything or visit you at your home.
Okay, so there's a clue. People trying to commit fraud against Medicare patients are visiting people's homes or calling them and talking to them about Medicare as if they were from Medicare. And of course, the government will never do such a thing.
Medicare, or someone representing Medicare, will only call and ask for personal information in limited situations.
Except in limited situations.
A Medicare health or drug plan may call you if you're already a member of the plan.
Like if you actually have a Medicare drug or health plan, well, then they might call you.
The agent who helped you join can also call you.
Assuming you actually remember the agent that helped you join, they can, of course, call you. Of course, you know, one of the problems with these things is that if I call you and say, I'm the agent that helped you join Medicare, well, then okay, then I can talk to you. Well, how am I going to remember the voice of the person who helped me join Medicare however long ago? How am I going to remember, you know, which plan I was in at some point a couple of years ago? And even if I do remember those things, it's not that hard to figure out what plan you're in because you present it to so many people in so many places. So, you know, one of the things about that system is if there are obvious attempts where somebody says, hi, I'm Billy Bob, I'm not from Medicare, I'm not from your plan, I just want you to give me your information. Okay, probably you shouldn't, but otherwise these are really not as helpful as they might seem.
A customer service representative from 1-800-MEDICARE can call you if you've called and left a message or a representative said that someone would call you back.
I don't know if you remember when you called us for some assistance on your Medicare payment plan last year, but my name is John Smith, and I'm here calling you back on behalf of that plan so we can discuss changes to your Medicare program.
If you filed a report of suspected fraud, you may get a call from someone representing Medicare to follow up on your investigation.
Hi, I'm John Smith from Medicare, and I'm following up on an investigation into Medicare fraud. It's my understanding that you're not part of this fraud, but ...
Don't give your Medicare card, Medicare number, Social Security card, or Social Security number to anyone except your doctor or people you know should have it. Like insurers acting on your behalf or people who work with Medicare, like your state health insurance assistance program, SHIP.
In other words, there are lots of people you should be giving it to, and figuring out which is which, of course, is the challenge. And, of course, the bad guys know that, and that's, you know, what they do. They try to get those numbers and that information so they can take advantage.
Don't accept offers of money or gifts for free medical care.
Apparently, people are offering free medical care, and using that to get the numbers and the other information they need from you to be able to rip off Medicare, or perhaps rip off you.
Don't allow anyone, except your doctor or other Medicare providers, to review your medical records or recommend services.
There are all sorts of things people can do if they have access to your medical records or these sorts of things. And the reason is, once they know what your conditions are, they can exploit it directly towards you, towards your relatives, towards your friends. They can use it against medical providers. That information is sort of the cornerstone to being able to make acceptable things like charge money for procedures that would be legitimate for you potentially, except of course they're not being performed and the money is going to a provider who's not a real provider, or, you know, who's a real provider that's also taking money on the side and, you know, splitting it with the con people. Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books. This segment is called, How Do They Do That? While threat actors already know how, many executives don't believe it's possible. We explain it so even a CEO can understand it. The way most of these confidence games work is not really very complicated and doesn't involve a whole lot of cyber trickery. Largely, it's people who take on the system, in many cases, by systematic frauds. They'll start with a doctor who's corrupt. The doctor who's corrupt, wanting to make money out of the system, will be charging patients for Medicare treatment and other, you know, drugs, whatever. but they won't actually be performing those services. And in many cases, those patients aren't even aware of the process. So what they need is some sort of a person to go out and find the necessary information so they can commit the fraud properly. The information includes the Medicare numbers and so forth, the information on your condition and so forth. And once they have the right set of information, they can identify what the procedures are, what the drugs are, and so forth, and carry out those frauds. They get paid. They give a percentage to the people that committed the direct parts of the frauds where they got the information from you and so forth, and that's how it works. The mechanisms they use vary, but one of the things they'll commonly do is use internet email. They'll use voice calls. They may even emulate somebody else's voice. They may seem like they have authority. They may use various technical means to make it look like they're coming from Medicare. Perhaps there's an association of the word Medicare in the name that's given by the call number ID and so forth. And then they'll lie. You know, they lie about this or that or the other thing. They may give you part of a number and make a mistake so you can correct it and so forth. Whatever they do, they're trying to use the way the system normally works to trick you into giving them information that they need in order to fraud the system. Now, that's the one half where they're defrauding Medicare, and that's largely what Medicare seems to care about in their descriptions. The other side of that is defrauding you. When they offer things to you, they might say, look, this is covered by Medicare, there's a Medicare discount, blah, blah, blah. So part of what happens then is you end up paying them and you expect to be able to write it off in one way or the other through Medicare or get reimbursed or you name it. And of course, when that doesn't happen, you complain to Medicare and Medicare says we don't know anything about it and you probably blame the system. The truth of the matter is that confidence people that, you know, rip people off for money and goods and services do this all the time. The third area where this takes place is in the drug business. So one of the tricky things is to get prescription drugs. So in some cases, people will actually show up at doctor's offices with your false information and demonstrate some appropriate symptoms for whatever it is they're trying to get drugs for. The doctors will write a prescription and they'll be able to get those drugs. They then take those drugs and sell them on the black market. Of course, in some cases, the doctors are involved, so it doesn't take much of a fake because the doctor's in on it. They give multiple prescriptions for things that are potentially dangerous drugs, Oxycontin, fentanyl, you name it. So that's how these frauds tend to work, and that's how they do it. And that's how you do that. Pete Herzog can best be characterized as a hacker. He's been a hacker since he was young. He's been on both sides of the line between good and evil, if you will call it that. And his career has affected a lot of people, all the more so since he started working on open standards and Hacker High School. Here's Pete.
So now I've talked to you, and you're aware of iZen, this other company that I work with that does online education, and they're right now focused on a program that's working with the U.S. DoD to develop essentially a high school curriculum for cybersecurity to get young people engaged and active and so forth. And what they have is a learning management system, and they're trying to automate a lot of these things so that you can scale it really, really well, but also trying to bring the gamification and the ability to do quizzes so you can do some sort of grading. And a variety of different sort of multimodal methodologies behind this. Can you talk about what you think the future path is for really scaling this, right? The workforce requirements for cybersecurity are, at this point, people claim there are a million cybersecurity experts needed in the U.S. economy alone, and I think there are 100,000 worldwide that might qualify. So and even if you train lots of them, it's going to take years to get through the program. So we're looking at you know, 10 to 20 years of shortfall. So how do you address this? How do you scale it?
Well, I think for one, I think the numbers about cybersecurity professionals and how many need it, I think a lot of times when people say, well, they don't see it, I think it's because a lot of it is wrapped up in what is basically sold as IT these days. So they're looking for IT professionals that can also do cybersecurity because, you know, they're a small organization, that kind of thing. But what we ended up doing is we approach this, again, we have lessons that we create that focus a lot heavily on narrative. So because young people learn better through story, and that's something that Bob does really well for us. And we build out these narratives and then we add skills to them. And one of the things is when we say gamify, I've seen a lot of this kind of gamification just fall flat, especially for young people, because, you know, they play with some some really amazing looking video games these days, right? The graphics, the sound, it's like playing a movie that they have. And they don't fall for the gamification, which is just glorified administration. Yeah, they don't fall for that. That's boring and uninteresting to them. So we actually try to use real games and create lessons out of that that fit the lessons that we're teaching them at the time. But now we're also using a learning management system. As a matter of fact, we just partnered with Quinnipiac University, which is on the East Coast, and they are giving us their LMS to build on. And we were going to be exporting shells from there to provide to the schools to sell or provide. Or there's some things we need to work on. But that shell is going to have all of the instruction on how they do the class and all of the materials and the games and, you know, all of that is going to be on another server. So that's going to link out from the learning management system to our content server, which is we use Rabbit Hole, which is an AI content server that allows us to sort of provide the documents and the videos in a searchable, communicable way.
Really, they can use the AI to ask it questions and get relevant material.
Exactly. And not only that, but since once it the AI ingests the documents, it can show them in real time. It remakes the page of where that information it got comes from those documents, so that they can read through them but not download them. They can bookmark it and that kind of thing. That it's a copyright issue, I think, for some of this works. Sure. So this way they can use that. They can use the games, they can use the cyber range, and it all links out from there. And that way we can better control the content, and it's not just on the one LMS, you know, and we can export it that way. So I think the future is going to be about having, and not just for cybersecurity, but yes, is having some of the best people you can have that can make content, making some of the best content, and really having that for anyone and everyone to learn from. Having something sort of standardized, being able to loop teachers in, because bringing the teachers up to speed, I mean, most of them are overworked and underpaid anyways. They shouldn't have to, on top of that, learn additional things. Plus, I can't tell you if a month goes by where I don't get an email from some sort of teacher saying, hey, I'm the gym teacher. They have me teaching cybersecurity next semester. Can you help me? You know?
There's a challenge.
And this is what we do. So our stuff allows the kids to learn from themselves. The teacher can learn along with it, as long as the teacher can be there to proctor and sort of make sure that the homework's delivered and verify that, well, that kind of thing.
We're learning together.
Yeah. And I think honestly, if we don't bring in esports or, you know, games, so to speak, and we don't sort of embrace how Gen Z and what is it, Gen Alpha next or whatever, if we don't embrace how they learn, which is video and interactive video through games, then we're not going to capture them at all.
So, Chris, my first impression is that young hacker has now become corporate good citizen.
Well, right. You know, and yeah, we all grow up, right? And become parents sometimes and so forth. And just thinking, listening to you guys talk, thinking about education, you know, let's be clear. You know, I worked 6 years in a printing plant and finally left in large part because I couldn't ever go to school again. You know, I worked midnight shift, afternoon shift, day shift. I couldn't go to night school, couldn't go to day school, couldn't do anything. And we look at how far we have to go yet with education, but where are we now? You know, there's you know, Hacker High School with Pete and you and Aizen, and there's online training, people getting degrees all the time everywhere. It's amazing, right? So look forward a bit, you know, focus just in on cybersecurity. You know, I agree basically with the entire conversation, right? There's all sorts of amazing things going to be happening in education. And this is one of these accelerators. Right. When you look, if you're looking at the future and doomsaying, you know, 30, 50 years from now, the world's going to fall apart. You know, just imagine the things we'll be doing differently. Imagine how far we'll advance in 30 years in education. You know, I think it's going to be amazing. And people will still complain at the time because it won't be perfect, but you have to stop and look back sometimes. It's stunning.
I'm actually unconvinced that education is going to progress. I think there's going to have to be some sort of very radical sequence of events that happens to change the nature of the way society thinks about education. I can't imagine the grade school, middle school, high school thing ever becoming tolerable to most people.
Well, but say the same things about sports sometimes, right? And people talk about tradition, right? You know, baseball, football, whatever else. You know, these things are at most like 100 years old. You know, there are people alive today who were, you know, little babies when they started. You know, this is not like the path of human history. This is just a, you know, it's a sports franchise. And
no, but education.
Public education, mass education is not much older than that.
You know, It's not true. So educational institutions are some of the oldest institutions in the world. Some of them are
universities for the parents. No, mass, you know, actual education as we would recognize it today, where all children go to school for lots of years. I mean, in my grandmother's time, that wasn't a thing. And
right, there were apprenticeships, but there was still education long before that.
My point is that what we see as the education system is a relatively short-term, ephemeral thing. You know, in our lifetimes, yes, it matters a lot. For our kids, yes, it matters a lot because that's the way it is right now. But we shouldn't look at it as some tried and true methodology. And I agree. I think, you know, the education system as we've known it has largely turned into daycare, right? So adults can all work three jobs.
That's one of the things that so there's been a lot of change in the educational system, apparently, since my kids went through school, which was not that long ago. They tell me that there's all this change, but I don't see a way to understand and realize it, right? That is, I don't think it's just daycare. I think there's plenty of stuff where they're teaching people things. But I also think that there's some bizarre, when they talk about the conditions in school and some of the stuff that they encounter, I don't understand how that's going to produce, I'll call it, well-educated, well-rounded, intelligent people able to cope with the issues of the world and advance the society in the era of technology that we are moving into and living in.
Yep. But again, you know, this is very similar to a lot of our conversations, right? You know, I don't think that, you know, we've been doing the perfect job to begin with. Right. And you know, as we move forward, you get new problems and some of the things that used to work aren't working anymore. But we advance. Right. Yeah. You know, there are, you know, literally now millions of people who are paid to every day to deliver and develop education. And they're all thinking about these things. And in the corporate world, you know, as you know, I'm very frustrated with, you know, the way we do meetings, like just Zoom meetings and all this. You get your entire workforce every day. And we think that all we need to do is throw a bridge and a, you know, laptop at them and everybody's going to be productive. Same sort of thing with education. It's like, you know, throw a book at the kids and they'll learn. It's like, not, this is complicated. All right,
so the people that do that way are doing it probably the way they did it in the office. And it was just as meaningless there as it is here. the meetings that we have, we have advisory boards for a bunch of companies. I have lots of meetings every week. They're shortened to the point and directed towards specific metrics and progress against specific objectives. And, you know, they're periodic as part of the control system, the enterprise brain, if you will, that allows us to advance and mature a company towards efficient operation and maintain it and measure it. And, you know, and so it's an approach to running companies. And I realize that people have meaningless meetings all the time, but that's certainly not what I see in the meetings that I'm willing to attend. I'm not the ones I hold.
But I think for our analogy here, though, you know, with, you know, the corporate communication systems, the educational communication systems, you know, are really thinking is what we're comparing. And they're both, you know, look, you know, I'm glad I don't have to drive to every meeting anymore. That would lower my productivity to near zero. However, I'd like to have much more efficient and effective and consistent and use the technology for something other than, you know, showing up in the room.
I'm not living in the same world as you, and you're familiar with this, right? So you've done some advisory work where, you know, we have systems that are tracking what we're doing in the meeting. The agenda is there. We're walking through it. We have time frames. We have people trying to get things done. We, you know, here's what you're going to be doing by next week or 2 weeks from now. Here's your goal. Here's your time frame. If you have any questions, here's the systematic approach. Here's the books. Here's the manuals, all deliverables with time frames and measurables. And, you know, I am not clear that other people have meetings that aren't that way, because I don't experience many, if any, of them, right?
Well, you know, in short, let's get back to our guest here, Pete, you know, Hacker High School. You know, I hear things like gamification, good content from good people, more intelligent design of the delivery, you know, and attention to the student. Oh, yeah, I got to say this one, you know, AI, right? You know, one of the applications of AI that has me excited, you know, and again, AI, quote unquote, whatever, you know, what we're talking about these days, is individual, lifelong individual student tracking, right? You know, imagine if, you know, education 300 years ago was for rich kids who had tutors who cared, who knew every single thing about that kid. You know, they knew them. In our era, you know, it's you know, teachers who see 30, 40 kids at a time for an hour or so at a time, rotating around, you know, year to year they change. And there is no one other than a good parent, you know, to track the individual issues of an individual kid to really, you know, help them, you know, best exploit their opportunity to get educated. That's coming to an end. I think the next couple decades, it's going to be one of these things when you look back, you know, as a teacher, as a parent, as a kid. And it's like, wow, yeah, they all just herded into the room and the teacher barely knew, particularly the quiet kid. You don't know anything about them. You don't know if they're really getting anything unless you give them a test. So that's
so
sort
as
of
an investor, help. As an investor in a number of educational companies and an observer of the field as it progresses and participating in a number of research and other related grants in the subject, I will tell you that the advancements you're talking about are nowhere near being realized. And everybody that has tried has really failed significantly at it.
Well,
AI
yeah.
is just not there yet. I mean, it's not, that's a long way from there. It's not creeping up on us. I mean, obviously, I could be wrong. It could all of a sudden change overnight, but I don't think so.
I think I was being conservative, but I said a couple of decades, you know, 10, 20, maybe 30 years. 30 years is pessimistic as heck. You know, I think in the next 10 years is probably optimistic. But I think the next decade out.
Yeah, I don't think so. I've been watching this for the last two decades and watching that progress, and it just is not happening. I mean, lots of people are trying lots of things, and each one of them has their sort of time in the sun, and then it fails again.
I haven't seen anything like the base of technology that I would expect to be able to even do it. I have not been paying attention to this for the last couple of decades because I don't think we've been anywhere close to it. I think we're getting close. I think people are overexcited about ChatGPT and all that stuff, large language models. However, I think when you extrapolate this out, you know, and the given all the, you know, pressures and opportunities and competitive pressures and economic pressures, I think the technology will catch up in the next 10 or 20 years, right? You know, if you don't have kids now and you're just going down that path, I think your kids in their school lifetimes will start to be able to. And again, this is a very specific application, right? I think it's very. You know, we have, like, as a parent, you know, I would have loved to have, a digital, not even tutor, just a bright enough entity to track all the aspects of my kid's education for their purposes, my purposes, their teacher's purposes. And I think that kind of thing is on the horizon. I think everybody working on it in advance has underestimated the problem, but I don't think we're that far out.
All right, well, I guess we will see, assuming we live long enough for that. The other things that I found interesting, you know, when he was talking about the gym teacher who's now teaching cybersecurity this semester, right?
Right.
Oh, my goodness. And look, so my daughter is, does physical therapy. One of my daughters does physical therapy stuff and yoga and so forth. And she's smart as heck, okay? And so I don't think that being a gym teacher, you know, or being a professional athlete makes you dumb. But I think that the notion that you're going to learn what you need to understand about cybersecurity every week before the student reads the same part of the book, I think it's nuts. But the other thing is, I probably think that any professional in any field thinks the same thing about their field. And they're probably wrong, just as I'm probably wrong.
Yeah, I think you know, it depends. I was thinking as I'm listening to you guys talk, right? You know, I want to be really clear. There's user training, you know, train the users to be cyber secure. I think it's an absolute waste of time. Sorry, a lot of friends, you know, get paid well to do it, but no. But education, when we're talking education, yeah, I think a competent teacher, I think we can scale this because you don't need to be a cybersecurity expert in some cases, right? You know, if you're doing it, you know, basic to high school kids and so forth, yeah, I mean, go a relatively bright adult with teaching experience, given the right content, you know, with someone to explain to them what the heck it is. The concepts are not that rocket science. They really aren't. What's rocket science is some of the tech behind it and you know, some of the other stuff. But there's a lot of basics to be taught really well.
At the high school level, I think it's actually much, much simpler, right? So we just finished developing a curriculum for high school level for the Navy on a program through ISA. And, you know, this was funded research and such. And, you know, the approach we took was very much gamification might not be the right word, but experiential, personal, right?
Yep.
It's about, you know, emotional connection. It's not about learning cybersecurity techniques.
Right.
At the high school level, any more than, I mean, so look, okay, high school chemistry might be about learning, you know, how to do some chemical processes and learning some basics of chemistry. But it's not turning you into a PhD chemist. You know, it's the basic. High school French, you're learning some words and how to conjugate some stuff, but you're really not going to be that good at French. Right? Now they don't teach French anymore, but that's when I was young. So, you know, in the cybersecurity arena, you know, what we're teaching them is more of the emotional connection to what's actually going on in the world and how people are taking advantage of each other and how to not be taken advantage of. But it's not about access control, right? It's not about, you know, setting bits, it's not about identity management. You know, it has nothing to the technology is not the fundamental here, right? The fundamental is you're using your bank account. What can go wrong, right?
Right.
Who do you trust and what do you trust them for? You know, why is it important to listen to what people tell you and think about it rather than just accept it, right? Why is it that when you get an email, you know, that, you know, it can break into your computer. You know, what do you do about that? Right? It's that kind of, you know, don't give away your banking information, right? So, you know, and so it's just not at that level the same thing. But what he's talking about is also about this issue of training the, you know, 100,000 or a million or however many cybersecurity experts you need to do the technical stuff, right? And when you're starting to drive into that arena, I think it cannot happen, right? I think we need a system, you know, created by geniuses for execution by idiots. Like, you know, that really you cannot expect you're going to have all that expertise working for any company, right? Certainly in your shoe store, you're not going to have a cybersecurity expert, right?
Right.
Even in a substantial manufacturing business, you're not going to have a cybersecurity expert. You're going to have outsourced, you know, people that have the equipment that does the manufacturing, and their job is to make sure the equipment does what it's supposed to do, regardless of being connected to a network or whatever else. And your job is, you know, you're going to have an engineer that knows how to twist the dials and tune this thing so that it produces the right product at the right quality level in the right time frame. And I just think that it's an evolution of the technology environment from here to there that we're looking at, not a education and training program for everybody that uses computers.
I think we're really at the moment, you know, talking about this with you, you know, I the long term, the big problems, the big challenges are so big, right? You know, I kind of feel that it's something I would love to have spent and maybe will at some point through my remaining career spend like all of my time or a big chunk of my time on it, because there's so many factors. right? You know, there's so the tactical, you know, the tactical work, I love doing that. You know, train a class, build a class, do a thing, right? Absolutely. And it's good experience and so forth. And it just makes the world a better place. But the on a large scale, I have to imagine if I was spending all the time I spent on everything else on education, had for the last couple of years, I would really love that sort of visibility into what's existing, what's been tried in the last, you know, decade or two, you know, how does this all mesh together? Because as I say, you know, this is, it's one of the, maybe the big problem. It's not about cybersecurity. We're talking about education, period, done. It's not about new versus old. It's just, it's everything.
I think that the idea of learning about how the world works, learning how to get along in the world, is something that's fundamental. But I think that if you're going to really know about any particular thing, that drill down into that particular field is just going to be something because you desire to do it. And it's not going to be part of general education. It's going to be part of a trade, right? Or a degree in this particular field. And that, you know, you should generally know about other things, but the idea that you can do those other things, look, I have a PhD in electrical engineering, but I am not the guy to wire my house. Trust me. You know, no, you do not want that. And I'll put in some plugs here and there, you know, and fix those in place. And I've practiced that enough to be reasonably good at it. But, you know, you and I have been talking about changing the power systems in my house, and there's no chance that I'm going to do that because, among other things, we have to connect to the power grid, and I don't want to kill the people that work in the power grid because of, you know, my stupidity in connecting the wrong way to the outside power. You know, because I looked at the diagram and said, I think this should go here. You know, no, sorry.
Yeah, there's, you know, as I said on the show many times, right, I have 20-something kids, love them to death. They're all kind of amazing. And I'm 58 years old, so I get to listen to all my friends my age and older. Not all of them, you know, but, you know, as you get older, you tend to say, gosh, it was so much better when I was young, and map that onto everything else. You know, the air was better, you know, playing was better, we had better education and everything else. And I think, you know, I think a lot of the speculative fiction, you know, in my younger days has already happened, right, in various interesting sort of ways. And I look out in the future, I think for my kids' generation and their kids' generation, a lot of it is not that unpredictable. I think people will specialize in things, as you're saying, because nobody's going to know everything because there's too much to know now and there's going to be more to know and. But, you know, we have to have, some of us have to have specialties, and people like doing things, right? And it's, but it won't be, you know, what we expected. It won't be what we're used to, by definition. But I see, yeah, one of my kids is an amazing artist, and yeah, school was always a struggle for them, and in the end, you know, we took them out of high school at the end, and instead, what they did was worked on art 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, to create what I think is going to be a really good career, right? And that was a better educational environment for them than sitting in, you know, high school classes. So it's, you know, this is, again, one of my inevitability curve things, right? You know, when problems get endemic enough, when they bother, and I don't mean things where everybody's hair's on fire, but when, you know, everybody or large portions of the demographics are generally unhappy with things, they'll create pressures that, you know, evolve issues in a more preferable way. And education is such a personal thing, and in every direction, for ourselves individually, for everyone we care about, for any kids we have, for society as a whole, I'm pretty comfortable we'll keep working it out. The marching morons sort of dystopian future stuff. Hey, you know, no, that's not going to happen.
I'm glad you believe that. And we will see what the future brings. We will no doubt be discussing this further in the future.
No doubt.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Vint Cerf is one of the best known early Internet ARPANET developers, researchers, and one of the folks that's considered by many as one of the founders of the Internet as it exists. He has continued to work over many years for a variety of companies and doing a variety of different work related to forming networks. Here's Vint.
Just a little background. I don't know if you've listened to the show. Since you didn't know it was a radio show, I suspect you haven't listened to it.
That's correct.
It's a dead giveaway. So the rules of the show are pretty simple. There's no politics, no religion, and none of the seven dirty words.
Oh, and, well, in that case, how am I going to deal with my title of Chief Internet Evangelist?
I don't see where there's anything religious in it, but...
Well, clearly, I'm geek orthodox.
You're geek orthodox. Well, there, well, in that case, I think that religion is allowed on the Cyber Show. We are all in that realm, I guess. And so you're allowed to hold more than one opinion, even about things where you disagree with yourself.
Oh, well, that's a good thing, because I find myself disagreeing with myself many times.
Well, I think we're all disagreeable to ourselves at times. So I think that's personal. So, so I just, you'll be on for a month and a half or so.
Oh, that's great. And you ripped the victim apart four or five times then. That's terrific.
Well, so I wouldn't say we're ripping you apart. You know, let's just say we're expressing commentary on the things, issues of the day. So I'm going to start. We have Vince Cerf here, who is currently, I don't know, one of those big companies somewhere. We'll allow them to remain nameless for the moment. And we want to start always with your background. So presumably you were born somewhere, assuming you're not automated. And at some point you went to some sort of schools. And what we want to know is sort of what school you went to and when you first encountered anything having to do with cyber.
Okay, well, I started out in New Haven at Yale Hospital in 1943. And moved to Los Angeles at the end of World War II because my father found work out there. Grew up in the San Fernando Valley, went to Van Nuys High School. And a brief pause here while I mention that several people who have had a great deal to do with the Internet and the ARPANET predecessor to the Internet went to Van Nuys High, namely Steve Crocker and John Postel and another guy named Carl Auerbach. There are other people who went to that high school, including people like Marilyn Monroe and Don Drysdale and Natalie Wood. It was a pretty amazing place. Of course, I wasn't there. They were not contemporary. Stacy Keach was also there. I did overlap with him a little bit.
So be true to your school would be a characteristic that we would attribute to you, right?
That one was benefited when I was there in the late 50s and early 60s because of the Sputnik event. The National Science Foundation responded with advanced physics and math and chemistry and so on. There was a rapid STEM initiation.
Yeah, so when we use initials on the show, we spell them out. So that's science, technologies, engineering, and math, right?
That's right. They didn't call it that.
But they've added A to it. Now it's called STEAM.
Now it's called STEAM.
What's the A stand for?
It's probably arts, do you think?
There you go. So now it's just education.
It's liberal education. No, it was spelled differently.
I don't know about liberal. So you think conservatives don't educate the same way?
I think the term liberal education is distinct from the political notion of liberal and the political notion of conservative.
Okay, so what would a liberal education as opposed to a conservative education then be?
Well, I don't know that there is a term conservative education. There is a term liberal education. I think it says that you should learn more than just science and math and spelling and so on. You should know something about history. You should know something about literature, some of the arts. In fact, you notice that in many schools, you have a school of arts and sciences like Stanford University, where many disciplines, including literature and history and so on, are all kind of gathered together. Then there's engineering, which is a whole other thing. So, and I'm not sure that I have a definition for you for the as yet undefined term conservative education.
Well, we can always look it up on the internet, and if there isn't one already, the AI will create one for us, right?
Well, that's certainly possible, but remember, be careful what you, not only what you hear on the show, but also what you hear from the latest chatbot.
Especially the chatbot. While the show is unreliable, the chatbots are downright wrong.
Well, not always, though, and that's therein lies the problem.
That's the pernicious part. Sometimes they're right.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's like a broken clock. The thing that is so pernicious, I think, about some of the current state of the art of bots is that they always sound confident even when they're wrong.
Well, that's just like me.
Oh, okay. Does that mean that you are comparing yourself to a bot?
It does not mean that, but I am confident that you could misinterpret it that way.
Well, I just did, so that was fun.
Perfect. All right, so back to your education. Well, eventually we'll make progress towards bots.
Let's just finish the little education thing. After high school, I went to Stanford, and I majored in mathematics and minored in German. Spent some time in Germany as a Stanford in Germany student, and then went to work for IBM for a couple of years to see whether computing was going to be fun. And I liked it enough that I realized I needed to go back to school. So I went to UCLA to get a PhD in computer science and got sort of the second degree in that discipline at UCLA in 1970.
All right, we're going to pause here. This education thing is only so much, because what we haven't yet encountered is always leave them hanging.
Yeah, Beverly Hills 90210. Yeah, so, you know, the networks, you know, we talk to these folks over and over again. You know, I've called my, you know, day job calls and various other conversations I've had just today, right, with folks like Vint, right? And what you see is, yes, brilliant folks who did the right things, you know, at least often enough in life, you know, to have fascinating backgrounds, fascinating careers, and be able to, you know, influence the world, right? And but so much of it is situational, and it's not a matter of just fate. You know, as he was saying, as a very small child, he moved, you know, to Los Angeles, and that was the first step, right? But the networks we make, the people you know, right? Yeah, you know, and the steps you take along the way, right? You know, it's a very human system that makes this big technological infrastructure and business and everything else around it. It really is. It's who you know, but it's not a corrupted thing. It's individuals like everybody else, everybody you interview and everybody, you know, we work with to this day, who've taken the time and consideration and thought about things, where opportunities were happening, and let one thing lead to another and leverage that for good for themselves and hopefully for the rest of us.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because you were brought up without all those connections when you were young and those high school with all these other tremendous capabilities. And I was brought up in a place that, sure, it had plenty of high-tech stuff, but there were no connections into the sort of environments that I ended up being in any of those schools or any of those places. So, you know, these, I don't have childhood friends that, you know, became, you know, famous and well-known and in the movies and all these things, right? So I think that there is a distinction. But one of the really interesting things to me about that is now we talk about, you know, how these crazy parents, you know, are fighting when their kids are just born or before they're born to get them pre-admitted into the pre-preschool, you know, pre-pre-pre-preschool so that they're in the right kindergarten, so they're in the right. And, you know, we sort of laugh at it, but it actually makes a lot of sense as you start to look at that path forward, right?
Well, yes and no, right? You know, I truly believe in the you know, not just the American dream, you know, the liberal democracy dream, right? You know, the post-French Revolution dream where, you know, there's an opportunity, you know, may not work out for everybody, but you can get there from here. And as you say, I didn't have that sort of background, but a lot of us didn't. And some did. What I think is just fascinating, what I love about, you know, the B-sides Las Vegas, you know, God bless Jack Daniels and everybody else put that together, but the where you get such a diverse group of people. I mean, just as, you know, literally, you know, Oxford professors and all of that is tweed suit and, you know, leather elbows as you want with, yeah, bikers and cyberpunk, shaved head, everything. So it's, you know, I don't know the numbers, but I think it's more the exception than the rule, you know, to have that, you know, that Ivy League background or whatever, right? You know, say really, you know, rich opportunity space background. A lot of people that have got the multi-decade creds, you know, to do the kind of work that you do or Bent does, and, you know, arguably I do, and the people we know do, got here by interesting ways. I was just saying that on a call just before this, right, just talking to, you know, another one of us, you know, one of their early law folks, and it's just fascinating. I mentioned this show, you know, Fred and I, you know, do this show. It's like we talk to all these people, and it's like, think, 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 think. How exactly did you get here? Say that again. It's just amazing. So when somebody comes from a sort of standard background, it's no more surprising. It's like, that's just sort of fascinating. Stacy Keach, that's, you know, awesome.
Well, again, I think it's very interesting that he was in that well-connected environment. And as we go through the course of his life, that well-connected environment that persists. And look, this was not him getting into that well-connected environment. This is his parents getting into it. And there's also, of course, the multi-generational facet of this thing, right? So, you know, the old school is your great-great-great-great-grandparents dictated what caste you're in and what part of society you're in, and you're there. You know, that's it. You sort of have a guaranteed life, and if that life was a servant to the wealthy, then you're a servant to the wealthy. And if that life was a hunter, you're a hunter. And if that life was whatever you were indentured servituted into, right?
You know, we've had this conversation, and having spent half my life, particularly between the U.S. and Canada, as an American, very American person, and the subtle differences there, right? I love both these countries. I love the modern world. I love America for all its warts. But, that's exactly what you said right there. Break that caste, that class system, because the born into it sort of thing is the norm in a lot of, post-feudal Europe and its colonies, right? America, is a little bit better at wrestling with that, for better or worse. And I think, I'm a very active parent. So I have three kids in their 20s. I'll support them all their lives and give them everything, opportunity they can, because I love them. Is that good or bad? I don't know. I'm a dad. It's going to happen. When this happens with the feudal baron systems, then maybe we as a culture have something to worry about. But I think it produces all sorts of interesting things.
I think it also plays into this whole notion of trust architecture.
Right.
So sort of the architecture of trust in people historically has been from family and race and country. And in the, cyber area, it's going away. It has gone away in many ways, and its attempt to persist. So you see, in Silicon Valley and all this stuff where, women are discriminated against ridiculously, right? I mean, just for no sensible reason. You look at the statistics, it's nuts. And in fact, on average, successful women entrepreneurs are rarer, but more successful. But I think that has to do with the fact that it's more selective and that you can't hardly get in there. So you have to be awfully good to push past all that crap.
As I've always said about security, right? This same sort of thing. Equality. Look, I believe in freedom and democracy and equality and inclusivity and all of this. The freeing of individuals inside this, social and global structure so they can be who they are and so forth is a good thing, and I want it to be true. So maybe I'm biased towards this. But also, just like in the technology world, where cybersecurity makes things more efficient, now it's going to be adopted. Like, maybe you should have done it all along, but when it gets to that point where it lowers your costs, increase your profitability, makes you more competitive, then everybody adopts it. And it's no longer a matter of should you or not. It's if you don't, you'll just be wiped out because your competitors will lower their prices and take all your customers. Now you're out of business. And I think it's true with all these, post-feudal social structures, like, as you're saying, with gender-based or, skin color-based or whatnot. They're just, aside from being right or wrong, they're inefficient. They lower your opportunity space. They introduce costs. And they will fade over time like a mountain turns into a beach. Hopefully it doesn't take that long, but.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some sense, it might be all over, right? That feudal system might not be able to persist anymore.
Ask my kids' generation.
Well, because of the cyber world being the way it is, right?
Yeah. I mean, maybe we have new problems. We talk about those enough. But however, right? I think the momentum of social structures, we really, I think, underestimate this. Right. We say we can change overnight. We solve the, in the 1960s, Finn was just talking about, I was just, born in that period. But a lot of people through the 70s and 80s, my peer group, were like, well, we solved racism. Like, we had the civil rights movement. It's all done. It's like,
it's a
multi-thousand-year problem. It's not happening over in 7 years. This is going to take a while. But if you're on the right arc, and if you're, like I say, if you're right, if it's, you know, like getting people to do things because it's the right thing or a good thing, I'm all for that. However, you know, when it comes down to a competitive evolutionary advantage, then it's not philosophy anymore. Now it's just practical, and it's going to happen.
Yeah, I think it just can no longer persist because there, you know, there are all these forces at work, and you can fight against those forces, but you know, the provenance of your family only has so much force. Their wealth only has so much longevity. Their position in society doesn't last forever. Human memory being what it is, and we've discussed this, because lifetimes are only so long, when you get to where the only people that remember World War II are in their 80s and 90s and beyond, then all the lessons from then go away. And I think that's becoming slowly a global truth for many of the, I'll call it egalitarian-oriented societies. I think it continues to persist in some places, the oligarchs, right, and these sorts of areas. But I actually believe that the system of governance is going to change over to a more sort of socialist democracy sort of thing and stay there. While we are seemingly eternally at a tipping point, I think the fever is breaking. And I think as you try to push people who have been free into slavery, they will resist to the point where they will no longer allow themselves to be enslaved.
Yeah, you know, I agree, basically, in short, you know, the kinesthetic synesthesia, you know, the thinking shapes, you know, in complex relationships, you know, this to me, because I'm thinking a lot about the inevitability curve as we, you know, plan that series with Textron, but in trying to explain to people what I mean, this to me feels like a, you know, take a piece of metal and put a cone, you know, round cone shape in the bottom of it and stick your finger in and try to push one way or the other, right? You know, there's so much resistance as you go past that point, as you're saying, Fred, right? You know, and what people like is to stay right in that middle. As Terry Pratchett, you know, has, you know, his character, Lord Vedinari, say a couple of times in his books, you know, what people really like is that tomorrow is about like today, right? And we can all have different views on that, but that's actually what we want. We want a range of stability so that we can be free, you know, to have the range of movement that we want. And that may be a pretty long range, you know, and I'm a very, you know, I have my libertarian threads, you know, I literally like to stomp around the world and respectful to other people. But however, right, we need a certain repeatability. And yeah, you know, going back to old feudal systems and, you know, this is an educated 30 years ago when I started seeing the internet, you know, get used to having the same conversations over and over again. One thing that I found myself repeating was, what does it even mean? Ask yourself this question when, you know, the little girl in Afghanistan has access to all the information on Earth. Now we've had that. My kids have grown up with that, and they're in their 20s. And their entire world global peer group is basically the same. And, you know, yeah, it's not, it may be easier to deceive demographics and cause some of the problems we see today, you know, with enough effort. But, you know, reversing the course of the world so everybody gets to live in chains effectively, great.
Yeah. The other thing that I very much enjoyed was his description of himself as a geek orthodox.
I love it.
Yeah. So I think from a religious standpoint, we can allow that religion on the show because we are all members of it, apparently.
Oh, yeah. Well, when he said that to you, it just broke it down in my head. It's like, oh, absolutely, right? You know, so intrinsically to the bone, orthodox, yes. You know, as we discussed, I the old joke, hack the world. I mean it. You know, in your every essence and being, you know, hack the world. Yeah, you know, like this, hacking the world by talking with my friend and recording it and broadcasting in Silicon Valley on Wednesday mornings on a CBS radio show. Why not? While sitting in a boat, you know, and working with public and private sector partners to try to figure out supply chain security and singing to the manatees. You know,
there you go. Yeah. It's not a bad life, and it certainly is one you could not have lived this way 10 years ago or 50.
Or in 1873 or any other wonderful times people would like to go back
to. The history of humanity. Yes. All right.
No.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies. Next week on the Cyber Show, Vint cannot remember exact dates from 60 years ago. At deposition, he would likely have to say, I can't recall. Bob starts his hacking career at 9 years old with cotton balls, a child's toy, and a wire hanger. Or is that a hanger? More on Cognitive Defense's free webinar, an update from old friends, more fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time and bow. A good time and bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.